All rise. The Chief Judge and the Judges of the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. Good morning. Major Porterfield, I understand you're reserving 5 minutes?
Yes, Your Honor.
Are you prepared to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Captain Unsinger, are you prepared to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, then we'll hear the case of the United States versus Airman Basic Danilo. Major Porterfield.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Major Naomi Porterfield, and I, along with Colonel Don Christensen, represent the United States in this matter. Subject to the court's questions, I'd like to focus my argument today on the military judge's finding that appellee's speedy trial rights were violated under Article 10 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And the United States asserts that the military judge erred in his application of the law in this case. Applying a de novo review, this court will, of course, be required to conduct an analysis of the four factors outlined in Barker. Now, for purposes of this argument, we would like to focus on the military judge's erroneous application in three particular areas. First, the improper weight given to the facts of this case. Second, the unreasonable standard placed on the government. And third, the failure to give proper weight to the lack of prejudice in this case. And turning to the first area, the improper weight given to the facts. Although the military judge went through the Barker factors in his analysis, he failed to properly apply the concepts to the facts of this case, taking particular umbrage with the explanation that the government gave for the initial delay in this case, specifically its strategic considerations in processing the immunity for the five cases it was prosecuting, stemming from the drug ring taking place at Shepherd Air Force Base. Now, Plants and Shakur both tell us that appellate courts have the power to reverse when the military judge misunderstands the legal significance of a fact when that misunderstanding causes an error in his conclusions. And that's what we have in this case, as in Schuber, another 62 handled by this particular court, where this court found disagreement with the military judge's failure to give credence to the government's proffered explanation for the delay. Now here, the military judge's ruling wholly ignored the affidavit given by the Chief of Military Justice outlining the strategic considerations in processing post-trial immunity for these five separate prosecutions.
Was the affidavit given in the initial session or the post-trial 39A session?
The Captain Doherty's affidavit was given as an attachment to the government's initial response to the defense's motion to dismiss.
And going along that lines, what is your opinion on whether we can consider the post-trial 39A session or not?
Well, the government believes that the post-trial session, my first response is whether it is truly a post-trial session, because as the military judge noted in the Article 39A session, he sort of jumped the gun with respect to authentication because he had not received the written notice. So to that extent, it's unclear from the record whether it was in fact a post-trial session. But even if this court were to consider it a post-trial session, the analysis to the post-trial session indicates that they can properly be held for reconsideration. And to the extent there's any ambiguity in the rule, the military judge's discretion in considering that evidence should certainly be recognized by this court and how it played a role in his reconsideration. He accepted the facts. And there's no reason why this court should not consider those facts in analyzing whether he was correct in his analysis with respect to the motion for reconsideration.
I guess my question then is, I'm a little confused. So you're saying, regardless of the fact that he authenticated the record, he can still conduct a post-trial 39A session and there's no problem with that?
Well, Your Honor, I guess maybe to take a step back, if the record is authenticated, certainly any hearings after that are considered post-trial sessions are to be analyzed within the context of RCM 1102 as opposed to other RCMs that might be applicable. And so if RCM 1102 applies, the analysis to RCM 1102 states that Article 39, post-trial Article 39A sessions can take place for purposes of reconsideration. And so
they say they can take place after authentication of the record.
Yes, Your Honor. In the analysis, it discusses reconsideration taking place. It specifically outlines in the actual text of RCM 1102, it specifically outlines certain reasons why post-trial 39A sessions can take place, and then specifically precludes others. Reconsideration motions for 62 appeals aren't listed in either category. They're neither forbidden nor specifically authorized. But when you look at the analysis, it does discuss reconsideration as a proper basis to conduct an Article 39A session.
Yeah, but how does this fall with RCM 908 B4?
Well, I think the court has to look at both B4 and B5 in analyzing this issue. B4 states that, of course, the appeal essentially stays the ruling.
Right.
And so the ruling that is stayed, which is essentially the effect of that ruling, meaning that the charges are not dismissed. So the military judge dismisses the charges in his ruling effective 10 August, but the government's appeal that took place at the end of the day on the 13th of August stopped the effect of that ruling.
Yeah, but it says automatically stayed and no session of the court may proceed.
Well, yes, Your Honor, but taken in context with both B4 and B5, B5 states that the record was not to be authenticated it doesn't say the record was not to be authenticated, but it says the record shall be produced verbatim and authenticated after the written notice that's given for the appeal. And so the military judge sort of jumped the gun, and he recognized this in exercising his discretion to consider the facts in reconsideration.
Okay. I'm going to ask you to go back to Article 10. I know we kind of took you away. I just wanted to know what your feeling was on that, since it hadn't really been
discussed. Yes, Your Honor, it hadn't been discussed. And the government's position is, of course, that the court does have jurisdiction to hear this appeal, both appeals, the two separate notices of appeals with respect to the original ruling on the 10th and the ruling on the motion for reconsideration on the 23rd of August. Turning back to Article 10, the military judge's finding, of course, he was very particular to criticize the government's failure to obtain immunity until a couple of months after the appellee was in pretrial confinement. However, he did not give the credence the government any credence for the strategic considerations it was authorized to exercise in trying to balance these several prosecutions that were taking place out of the single drug ring. From the initial ruling, when he completely ignored the affidavit, even through the ruling that he made in his motion for reconsideration, calling it an unjustifiable excuse. And it's interesting that Barker, although it's a Sixth Amendment case, is the only other case that's cited that deals with the government delay being due to waiting for an accomplice's trial in order to testify. And in that case, there was a 5-year delay, but the Supreme Court did recognize it as an appropriate justification, among other things that were taking place in that case. So that's the first problem with the military judge's ruling, his failure to properly give credence to the proffered explanation by the government. The second reason that his analysis was flawed in his application was the unreasonable standard he placed on the government. And while the military judge did cite a variety of cases that were applicable, he still seemed to hold the government to a constant motion standard, citing 2 days here and three days there, many of which included weekends, and even the particular focus that he had on the 14-day delay between the appointment of a PCRO and the Article 32 taking place, not making any mention of the fact that defense indicated its availability and made no contest to the scheduling of the Article 32 on the 28th of June as opposed to the 14th of June. did not mention that fact in either ruling. So the military judge also discounted the lack of experience and some other things that were taking place in the legal office, which Kossmann tells us must be realistically balanced, because we have to look at the proceedings as a whole. And so the constant motion standard that the military judge seemed to apply in outlining 22 separate points where he felt the government took a little too long to get something done, whether it was waiting for an email response from Captain Lane, as exhibited by Attachment 6 to the government's motion for reconsideration, or other minor delays, they were consistently exercising steps to move the case forward, whether it was in negotiating pretrial agreements with all of these five separate prosecutions in order to obtain post-trial immunity, or once they aborted that course of action when they realized it was taking too long. Again, that's not the 4 years that was present in, the 4 or 5 years that was present in Barker. This was, we're talking about less than 60 days that they waited before they aborted and proceeded forward to try Airman Danilo. And the government, in its motion for reconsideration, specifically responded to each of the 22 problems that the military judge outlined he had with the government's delays, whether they pertain to the immunity or other problems like the unavailability. There was a 7 or 8 day unavailability of the GCMCA that was a problem at some point, delaying the immunity and the referral package. And so even, again, after the motion for reconsideration that clarified a lot of the facts that were presented in the original motion response, the military judge still did not give the government credit for expeditiously moving the case along, and seemed to still hold them to that constant motion standard that it's well settled is not the standard in this case or in an Article 10 analysis. Brief periods of inactivity are allowed in an otherwise active prosecution. And the record makes clear in Appellate Exhibit 3 and 4, that the government was exercising active and in an active prosecution. The final way in which the military judge erred in his analysis of this case was in the failure to properly give weight to the lack of prejudice. As I mentioned, Barker is the only case that's cited. Again, it's a Sixth Amendment case, but it does give us insight into, of course, the four factors that we're using here, but into the proper weight that's to be given to these various factors. Now, Barker reemphasizes that, you know, speedy trial is a nebulous concept and that the analysis has to be integrated. No one factor is particularly significant, which is interesting because despite his findings with respect to the other factors, the military judge honed in on the reasons for the delay and his contention that it was an insufficient reason, and did not give a proper weight to the absence of prejudice. In Barker, despite the five-year delay, the Supreme Court found that the appellant's speedy trial rights in that case were not violated because they were outweighed by other factors, including the absence of prejudice. And in analyzing the factors that we consider as prejudice, the absence of any hamper to his defense is what the Supreme Court pointed to as the most significant prejudice factor. And there was no evidence presented to the military judge that there was any hamper to appellant's or appellee's defense in this case. Now, appellee would argue that the military judge found prejudice. And I would submit to the court that argument is sort of a misnomer because it does not distinguish between prejudice in the colloquial sense and actual prejudice as it's considered and as it's analyzed under Barker, legal prejudice. And the military judge did not find any legal prejudice in this case. And the actual prejudice that the appellee is referring to is just the typical anxiety that's recognized by these courts in Barker and in Kossmann and in Schuber, et cetera. So there was no prejudice found. And the military judge sort of glossed over that particular fact.
You're saying there's no prejudice here?
There's no legal.
Just little?
there's no legal prejudice. There's no legal prejudice in this case. Now there is some prejudice with respect to the anxiety that appellant experienced, or appellee, I apologize, experienced, as noted by the military judge in his finding. That the United States is not contesting that. But in terms of the analysis of prejudice, the hamper to his defense, the three, Ms. Gala gave us three factors to consider in prejudice. And one of them was to prevent oppressive pretrial incarceration, minimizing anxiety and concern, and limiting the possibility that appellee's defense will be hampered. And in this case, while the military judge found that there was some anxiety experienced by the appellee, he found an absence of prejudice. And I'm looking at the military judge's ruling, which is Appellate Exhibit 4, his initial ruling. Appellate Exhibit 4, and paragraphs 85, paragraphs 84 through 86. So, and he discusses it again in Appellate Exhibit 9, summarily. But balancing all of the four factors in Wingo, it's clear that the military judge's application of the facts in this case, particularly his discounting the strategic considerations of the government in balancing the immunity and obtaining post-trial immunity, represented a misapplication of the facts of the law to the facts of this case. And if there are no further questions by the court,
Counsel, I want to get into the 707 speedy trial
issue. Yes, Your Honor.
How is it that the appellee being put into transition flight did not start the speedy trial clock, especially when he was placed in the Condition 1 status?
Well, the military judge did not find that Condition 3.
Correct.
Right. So I just want to make sure I understand your question. We're not appealing that part of the military judge's ruling, but with respect to Condition 1, his placement in Condition 1, what the court did in its initial ruling was to rely on Murr, which was an Article 13 case, as opposed to rely on Glaze. And then even in its ruling with respect to the motion for consideration, the court just decided not to rely on any of the existing case law for analytical purposes and just look at the facts of this case.
Okay, well, you would agree neither of those cases are controlling here.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. But they are helpful in understanding how courts analyze
what constitutes.
Well, I
would ask you, what case is controlling in this, or most controlling that you found?
Well, unfortunately, Your Honor, there's not a litany of cases that at least that the government could find with respect to transition flight being tantamount to confinement. Which is why
What about it constituting restriction?
Restriction with respect to 304?
Restriction in lieu of arrest or arrest.
Well, Your
not
Honor.
Just maybe not tantamount to confinement, but otherwise constituting a start to the speedy trial clock.
The only case that the government is able to find with respect to transition flight are, unfortunately, these unpublished cases. This unpublished case in Glaze, which deals specifically with Shepherd Air Force Base, the government does not believe that this was disqualified as an arrest.
Why?
That would be, well, the first reason is the context that this took place in. Of course, if we were at Bowling Air Force Base and the things that were imposed upon the appellee in this case were imposed upon myself, it would be a different analysis. But the Glaze, both Glaze and Murr actually tell us that that we need to look at the context and the circumstances, the totality of the circumstances. in determining whether something is an arrest. In this training environment, a fact reiterated by this court in Glaze, understanding it's not controlling but useful, the court specifically reiterated the importance that the training environment has in analyzing whether something is an arrest. It compared the condition status that is present in this case to the phase status that all airmen are subject to at Shepherd Air Force Base because it was a technical school training environment. And
but these individuals are no longer in training. They are pending disciplinary action under the UCMJ. So they are no longer in a training status. So doesn't that differentiate them from the others?
Well,
they're not going back to work.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that all of the airmen in the transition flight were pending UCMJ action necessarily. Some of them were pending separation and or otherwise taken out of the unit because of the problem that they were having on good order and discipline within the.
Well, I thought the military judge found that these individuals were not going to return to duty. They were either facing UCMJ action or separation.
And Your Honor, I believe that was the finding, that it was either UCMJ action or separation. And the evidence before the they were designated.
Were they still trainees then?
Well, Your Honor, the military judge's finding at Appellate Exhibit 4, Paragraph 4, states that transition flight is designed to house airmen who are designated a disciplinary problem or disruptive to their units, which is consistent with the instruction that was provided as an exhibit as to the purpose of transition flight and why in a training environment it was necessary outside of military justice to separate individuals who were disciplinary problems from otherwise compliant airmen.
Yeah, can I ask you, in your brief you talk about this is administrative restraint for purposes of reconditioning. What can you define what a reconditioning is?
Well,
I mean, what are you reconditioning them for?
Well, if you take the concept that training, that transition flight is designed to take an airman who is a disciplinary problem and separate him from having a negative impact on good order and discipline, to that extent, transition flight can serve as an opportunity to re-blue someone, as is the case with like correctional custody or some other programs that we have in the Air Force.
Were they really re-bluing these airmen?
Well, and Your Honor, there's no evidence that was the case with respect to Danny Lowe, and the government is not submitting that was the case with this particular appellee. However. The setup of the conditioning program, the phase up, phase down program, was designed in the context of a training environment. And the fact that his placement in condition one status was due to his own misconduct is another factor ignored by the military judge that was of critical importance in the Glaze analysis.
Let me ask you this.
I think we're going to ask the same question. Okay. Go ahead.
What triggered the change from condition 3 to condition 1?
Because misconduct
is what got him in pretrial confinement. So
right, additional misconduct. He, and Your Honor, I'm not sure it'll take. The conduct that was the subject of charge 2 is what landed him in pretrial confinement.
We understand that.
Right, and the conduct prior to that landed him in condition 1 status. Forgive me, Your Honor, I may have to answer that question on rebuttal just because I don't have it at my immediate
disposal.
But there was a triggering event that landed him in pretrial. Yeah, I mean, not in pretrial, but in condition placement in condition 1.
Yeah, I reread the testimony by Sergeant Herrera, and I couldn't find it. She didn't understand why he went from 3 to 1.
Right. Her testimony was ambiguous in that regard. I do recall that. Yes, Your Honor. And I'd have to provide that answer to you on rebuttal if, with the court's indulgence.
Mm-hmm. What about your position that even if we would find that the speedy trial clock started with him being placed in transition flight in condition one, how does that, your position is that the assault charge would not be affected. If all the other charges were, that would not.
Certainly.
And you base it upon the language in 707
B2
called multiple charges. And I just would like you to explain how you come to that conclusion that the assault charge wouldn't be affected because it was preferred at the same time as the others, and the precatory language to this paragraph says when charges are preferred at different times. Well, in this case, all the charges were preferred at once. There was not a preferral of an additional charge. So how does that provision apply here?
Well, the government's position is that the triggering event for the RCM 707 analysis, if the triggering event is pretrial constraint, as it was in this case, then even if the military judge found that that the triggering event for the first set of charges for the offenses that were the subject of charge one were triggered by his placement in condition one, he had not yet committed the offense that was the subject of charge two. And so it's unreasonable if you look at the RCM analysis, 707 analysis, for the court to backdate essentially the triggering event for an offense that the appellee has not even committed.
But how do you interpret the plain language of the provision?
I think the government is looking both at RCM 707A2 and RCM 707B2. And in the context of 707B2, we were using that more of, as an example to indicate that the calculations are charge specific, that the calculations for purposes of speedy trial are charge specific. And so by way of example, if the trigger is preferral, then it's supposed to be analyzed for each charge, the preferral of each charge. But if the trigger is not preferral, if the trigger is as it was in this case, pretrial restraint or confinement, then the trigger should be specific to each charge. And in looking at RCM 707 as a whole, it would seem counterintuitive. And I see that my time has expired, but if I may finish.
Yeah.
It would seem counterintuitive for the court to hold the government accountable for processing a case for a crime that had not even been committed by the appellee.
Thank you, Major Porcia. Captain Unseeker.
Good morning, Chief Judge Brand, honorable members of this court. May it please the court. In this case, appellant was restrained for 121 days, beginning with his T-flight status changing from condition 3 to condition 1. The government failed to act diligently in bringing this case to trial. The proper remedy for an Article 10 violation is dismissal with prejudice. The military judge in this case also made the proper decision with respect to RCM 707. The military judge's findings of fact are supported by the record. He understood and applied the law correctly, and his decision dismissing the charges with prejudice was therefore property. So first I would like to talk about Article 10.
For 707 he dismissed without prejudice, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
I misspoke there. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Honor.
Yeah, I just want to make sure. Thank you.
So I'd like to start off by talking about Article 10 and then move into RCM 707. So beginning with Article 10, the military judge did not abuse his discretion in finding an Article 10 UCMJ violation. In this case, appellant was restrained within the meaning of Article 10 for 121 days. Now, Congress has defined arrest as the restraint of a person by an order or imposed as a punishment. Now, this all comes from Article 9. That's where we impose the restrictions with Article 10. But, however, even if this court didn't consider appellant or appellee's time in T-flight, those 6 days he spent there before he entered pretrial confinement, still would meet the criteria of Article 10 violation in this case because he did enter actual pretrial confinement on 16 April 2010. Which he remains there to the present day. Under Article 10, the government has the burden to show that the prosecution moved forward with reasonable diligence. A conclusion of unreasonable diligence may arise from a number of different causes and need not arise to the level of gross negligence. And unlike RCM 707, the requirement for a speedo trial under Article 10 does not stop at arraignment, it ends at trial. So when we trigger an Article 10 violation, we have to look to the Barker factors, and that's Barker versus Wingo, the Supreme Court case. And of those factors, we look for the length of delay, the reason for the delay, whether or not there was a request for a speedy trial, and what the prejudice to appellee was. So I'd like to start off by addressing each one of those factors, if I may, Your Honors. So as we move into the length of the delay, here, appellee had served 121 days of pretrial restraint at the time of his arraignment. In this case, the OSI report closed out on both offenses, both for the charge 2 and charge 3, as well as the first charge, which were the drug offenses, by 17 April of 2010. The primary evidence, therefore, was available to the government at that point on April 17th, which was right when appellee had entered pretrial confinement. The military judge probably found that the focus of Article 10 is on the government and that the government did not pursue this case with reasonable diligence. Consequently, the duration of restraint in this case is sufficient to trigger further analysis under Barker. So when we move into the reasons for the delay under the Barker analysis, we look at this case and there was numerous periods of unexplained delay in this case, negligible by the government. And there's a CAF case similar on point to this case. That's the United States versus Hatfield. In that case, the trial judge, his conclusion was that the government had taken an excessively long time to bring an uncomplicated case to trial. There, the trial judge found five separate intervals totaling 48 days where little or nothing was accomplished with respect to moving this case forward to trial. And he noted that you can combine a lot of periods of small inactivity to find an Article 10 violation in that case. And it's important to note that that Hartfield case also seems to give some deference to the military judge's discretion at trial and what he finds with regard to reasonable diligence. It doesn't say that this court has to find deference to the military judge, but it certainly lends itself to that. In that Hartfield case, some of the same similar facts there was that in that case they had already finished the investigation. Now, it had been done sufficient time previously to the appellee in that case entering pretrial confinement, but it's much the same here, whereas you have an investigation that's already done when this appellee is entering pretrial.
Does the fact that this is a drug ring involving five different people at a technical training base that has lots of court-martials, as a matter of fact, maybe the busiest base in the Air Force, enter into it at all?
Certainly case law has raised that as one factor. I probably would argue that it's a minimal factor. There's a lot of other options for the base legal office when they're busy like that. And I believe it was Barker versus Wingo that actually said the government ultimately bears the burden for ensuring sufficient resources are available to move the case along, as well as United States versus Thompson, and I'm quoting from this, as a general matter, factors such as staffing issues, responsibilities for other cases, and coordination with civilian officials reflect the realities of military criminal practice and typically can be addressed by adequate attention and supervision, consistent with the government's Article 10 responsibilities, Your Honor.
Counsel, in this case, you had other accused that were needed to prove up the case, correct? You dispute that?
No, not with respect to most of the charges. I think it actually the first one.
And as a matter of resources, all these folks had counsel who apparently were advising them not to speak without immunity. So that is a significant complicating factor, wouldn't you agree, that takes time?
Correct. Yes, Your Honor. And we don't dispute that, but what is disputed, it took 67 days from the moment that Apelli entered pretrial confinement to the point where they even preferred charges on him. And it was more of 57 days, I believe, until they made the decision to change their strategies where they weren't going to go for pretrial immunity anymore at that point. At that point, sufficient time had elapsed. We're talking almost 2 months at that point, Your Honor. So if I could, I would like to reiterate some of the, or run through some of the facts that the military judge found, some of the instances of delay. Again, prior to referral, the military judge found that the government failed to articulate any good reasons why 72 days elapsed between Apelli's incarceration and the preferral of charges. We know also that it took 13 days for the government to even start working on a proof analysis or drafting charges in this case after Apelli had entered pretrial confinement. Now, when we look at the reconsideration that the military judge, and Apelli does dispute that reconsideration, which I can get to in a moment, the government chalks that a lot of that stuff up to inexperience, counsel in the office, and also difficult ROIs in this case that they had to go through. As I noted before, the ROIs were available to the government by 17 April of 2010 for both or for all three of these charges. The pretrial confinement reviewing officer finished his report on the 23rd of April, and the draft charges were not given to the Chief of Military Justice on 5 May. So during that time, the government had a good idea what the charges were because they had to present that at the pretrial confinement review hearing for Apelli in this case. But yet, a sufficient delay from 23 April to 5 May before those are even given to the military, the Chief of Military Justice for his review. 5 days after the draft charges were sent to the legal office of Chief of Military Justice, the charges were routed to the numbered Air Force, so on 12 May. So another sufficient delay after that. And when you look at that motion to reconsider, the government doesn't deny or explain any of that delay in that case.
So the military judge called that, the viewing of the charges by the NAF, a preview, as an unnecessary bureaucratic process. What's the problem with the GCM authority, who is ultimately going to refer the case, looking at the charges to see if they believe they're sufficient for their purposes to refer later?
Your Honor, I don't feel that, or Apelli doesn't feel that there's any problem with the convening authority looking at those charges prior to referral or anything like that, but a delay of 8 days at a pretrial stage like this would seem unreasonable amount of time to do that, to just review those draft charges.
Even in light of the evidentiary complications involved here?
No, Your Honor. I mean, even in light of all these charges here, I still believe, or Apelli would still believe, that, you know, the convening authority has his legal office. They've prepared the proof analysis for this. The convening authority has his own staff judge advocate to explain this stuff at that level. I don't believe that a delay of 8 days just to review draft charges would be appropriate in this case. And the government noted in their reconsideration that they have an internal policy allowing 10 days for the numbered Air Force to review those. The government interviews its first witness on 4 June, and then 12 June, that's when the government decides to seek immunity and change. They decide to go the post-trial immunity route at that point. So they change their strategy at this point, but none of that should be held against Apelli. I mean, Apelli's been in pretrial confinement at that point for 57 days, which is a substantial amount of time during these proceedings.
Captain Unsucker, it is not material to the appellee's argument whether the T-flight condition 1 or 3 counts as pretrial confinement. It doesn't matter how long he was in pretrial confinement. You're saying Article 10 was violated under the circumstances of this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the 120-day doesn't matter to you. If he was in there 116 days, is it still violated? Is that your position?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Yes, Your Honor.
And you keep referencing the reconsideration motion. Now, in your brief, you said we shouldn't consider that. Which is it?
I don't think this court should consider it, Your Honor. I just reference it in the event that this court would assume that was legitimate. Appellee still doesn't feel that the government has met their burden of due diligence, even in light of that reconsideration. But no, I don't believe this court should consider that reconsideration, and the reason being is that under RCM 908B4 specifically says that when notice of Article 62 appeal is given, the court automatically stays any further proceedings with respect to those charges, and that didn't happen here. They went ahead and had the motion to reconsider and had a hearing on it, which violated RCM 908. So appellee's argument is that no, this court should not consider anything in those reconsideration hearings, any of the motions by the government that they presented, or any of those attachments to that motion for reconsideration, Your Honor.
So you're saying it's a notice given, not the authentication of the record, that triggers that this 39A should not have happened?
Correct, Your Honor. Now, we note that it was authenticated on 12 August, but in any event, the appellee doesn't feel that this was like a post-trial session. This was a motion for reconsideration, which the subject of it was these charges that had previously been dismissed by the military judge.
So I guess I'm confused. So trial counsel doesn't have the option to ask for reconsideration the minute the judge says he's dismissing with prejudice or without prejudice?
No, they have the right to do it, but once they give written notice pursuant to 908B4 of their Article 62 appeal, it automatically stays any further proceedings. It's at that point that it stays those proceedings.
So which is, I know you gave two reasons, but which is the primary reason? The fact that it was and I'm, you know, I read the record. I'm pretty clear that he authenticated on the 12th of August.
Yes, okay. Sir.
So, assuming that it was authenticated on the 12th of August, is that the thing that says you can't reconsider, or is it the 13th, the notice of the appeal?
It's the 13th, Your Honor. That's appellee's argument, is it's the 13th when they gave that notice of appeal under 908B4. It effectively stayed those proceedings.
So even if they had given, if they had put the motion for reconsideration in the morning and then the notice in the afternoon, opposite as to what they did, then you're saying that they could have reconsidered even though it was authenticated?
No, I believe they gave the motion for reconsideration in the morning, if I have my facts right.
Yeah, I thought it was the other way. I thought the notice of appeal was in the morning and then the motion for reconsideration was in the afternoon. Do I have it backwards?
They gave the motion for reconsideration at 10:20 hours on 13 August, and then they gave the written notice of appeal at 1600 hours later in the day. Was that what you said, Your Honor? Okay.
Okay. So even if they put the judge on notice of a reconsideration, mm-hmm. You're saying that he could have done it even though it was authenticated?
No, what we're saying is, I'm sorry, go ahead, Your Honor.
No, I'm just trying to understand what you're saying.
What we're saying is the government did put their motion for reconsideration in first, and then later in that day they asked for notice under Article 62 appeal. Certainly the government could argue some kind of constructive withdrawal of that Article 62 appeal. I think the proper thing would have been to do is to withdraw that first Article 62 notice of appeal by the government, which they did not do. So effectively, by them filing that, whether or not they had filed the notice or a motion for reconsideration or not, as soon as they filed that notice of appeal under Article 62, they automatically stayed any further proceedings, regardless of what they had done prior to that. The proper remedy would have been for them not to file that notice of appeal at that point, to go ahead and do the motion for reconsideration, and then after that, file their notice of intent to appeal under Article 60. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Well, then wouldn't your argument be to the court that they violated the 72-hour rule to file notice if they waited till reconsideration was done because the decision had already been made? So they're caught in a can't-win situation, if I'm understanding you. You're saying they should have withdrawn the notice to appeal and had reconsideration figured out, then put their notice to appeal. Well, what triggers the 72 hours where they have to file their written appeal?
Well, I believe it'd be the judge's answer to that reconsideration motion. They would be given 72 hours after that.
But so you wouldn't be arguing to me if they had done that, you wouldn't be arguing that they'd violated the 72 from the time you made the initial, excuse me, the initial ruling?
No. No, Your Honor. And it's important to note in that second notice of Article 62 appeal that they gave in the preamble that they do relate it back to the first one, say this is an addition to our original one. So there was effectively no withdrawal of that first Article 62 appeal notice. Is it okay if I continue with Article 10? Yes, Your Honor. When we look at more of these delays, and I'll go through these very briefly, there's significant delays with the referral process after that Article 32. The NAF gets the immunity letters and the referral paperwork on 8 July. The government, the legal office doesn't get those immunity letters back till 19 July, and they don't get the referral package back to the 23rd of July. And it's not till the 26th of July that they even serve those referral packages on the appellee in this case. So, again, the military judge reiterated in this case, it was this constant, inexcusable delays throughout the process was the biggest issue here. I've already touched on that. Here, the military judge's findings of fact are not clearly erroneous, and the government has therefore failed to demonstrate due diligence when we look at this prong of reasonable reason for delay. And it's also important to notice that there was no evidence presented of any defense delay in this case. Moving into the third prong, whether or not appellee had made a demand for speedy trial, he did effectively make a demand for speedy trial. It was on 3 May of 2010 that he made that demand. Your Honor.
Isn't there some case law that says basically the more times he demands it, the more onerous the situation is when we get to the final factor of prejudice?
Yes. Okay. Yes, Your Honor.
And he only made one demand, right?
He did. It was a speedy trial demand on its own. It was not such that it was tucked into discovery request. I know the court.
Right.
Noted. Okay, Your Honor. When we move
let me ask you this. On the detailing letter during the docketing conference, the government wanted to go on the 9th, which was a Monday. Defense wanted to go on the 10th. Isn't that evidence of some delay?
I apologize, Your Honor. You're exactly right. The ADC did delay by one day with
that
document.
That would put it right at 120. If I go with your calculation.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. You are
and
correct.
And then we wouldn't be arguing 707.
Well, potentially it would still be 120, 120 days delay, but certainly that's the potential that it would not be a 707 issue. Yes, Your Honor. When we look at the prejudice to appellee, the judge did find that there was anxiety and concern in this case. The government placed a lot of focus on the three factors in Barker versus Wingo, whether or not further prejudice to the appellant, whether he's going to be able to get witnesses. Anxiety and concern was certainly an issue involved in that decision. However, Barker went on to say that it's not limited to those prejudicial factors. There's a lot of other prejudicial factors that are contemplated by somebody to show prejudice under that prong. Most importantly, with the prejudice prong, is that at this point we can't fully evaluate what the prejudice of appellee is going to be. Appellee is still in pretrial confinement at this point. If he was to receive a sentence lighter than what he'd already served, there may be able to show prejudice even more so at that point. So there is substantial prejudice in this case. And the defense doesn't necessarily not meet this prejudice burden, it doesn't necessarily weigh in favor of the government, even if we were just to show a minimal anxiety and concern. The government hasn't been able to show on their side whether they have any prejudice in their case.
Counsel, I have to coming back. How do you answer the government's position that the judge did not give appropriate credence to the strategic immunity issue and planning involved? I mean, how do you answer that?
Well, it just seemed from the justification that the government gave that there wasn't sufficient progress made through that. Certainly, there was some difficulty in gathering that information, but the government had a lot of different options they could have went with. I mean, I understand hindsight bias is 20/20. The government could have tried Pelley for the things that they had him dead to rights on, which was...
But the case law doesn't impose that burden on the government. They have a right to choose and to choose amongst options and maybe abandon some and go with others. The case law doesn't require them to take any particular course under the Article 10 analysis, does it?
Certainly not, Your Honor. But again, when we look at the substantial delays or the numerous inexcusable delays that the government did during that pretrial processing and even after the pretrial, or even after the immunity decision strategy was changed, that's what Appelli points to, is that at each point in trial, it just seemed to take longer than necessary to move this case along. Pretrial immunity issues, while maybe somewhat difficult, shouldn't take 57 days to sort that out and figure out that, you know, this isn't the trial strategy we're going to use. This could have been decided a lot earlier when they noted that they were having problems getting to these other witnesses because they had defense counsel and things of that nature, Your Honor.
So your proposition was they should have tried the marijuana because they had the urinalysis and the confession, and then come back and got the rest later?
I'm not saying that's how they should have done it. I didn't want to assert any way that the government should try their case. I was just saying that's one option that was out there, one potential they could have looked at, Your Honor. So in this case, Appelli asserts that the military judge properly found under Article 10 that the government did not display a reasonable diligence in this case and thereby violated his Article 10 rights and properly dismissed his case with prejudice. If I may discuss RCM 707 grounds, again, RCM 707 requires that the government bring an accused to trial within 120 days after the earlier of the preferral charges or the imposition of pretrial confinement. Now, what's important to note in here is that I know the government cites the Glaze case, but it seems that Glaze is not wholly on point, as it deals more with Article 13 pretrial punishment and whether or not his conditions were tantamount to confinement, which is not the issue in this case. To trigger 707, Appelli would have to show that he was restrained with respect to 304. A2 through A4, whether he was in restriction in lieu of arrest.
Well, why doesn't this fall under H?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Why doesn't this fall under 304H?
If I may, 1 second, Your Honor.
Administrative restraint.
Oh, it certainly could. I mean, he was administratively restricted as well in this case, but even that withstanding, he was restricted within what 707 contemplated because of his conditions in T-flight when they went to condition. Oh, sorry, Your Honor.
I'm saying.
Oh, there, with condition one. The conditions endured by appellant in Shepherd's T-flight between 10 April and 16 April were such to trigger 707. The conditions were more severe than administrative restraint or in conditions on liberty. In some of those conditions, I would just go through. He was restricted to base at all times. He had to sign in and out to leave the building. And when he left the building, he had to be escorted. Now, he was allowed one trip to the mini mall a week, one trip to the library, and both times he had to be escorted during those times. Couldn't be in his room sitting or laying on his bed from 0600 to 1800. He couldn't have
visitors. How is that any different than phase one of basic training or tech training? Are the trainees allowed to go lay around on their bed anytime they feel like it?
No, that's just one factor, Your Honor.
Okay, but I mean, and restricted to base, aren't trainees in phase one restricted to base?
Certainly.
Have to wear their uniforms all the time?
Certainly.
Can't use cell phones, can't smoke, can't drink, pretty much can't go anywhere outside of a very confined area?
Certainly, okay. But he had passed that phase in training. Now, he wasn't necessarily a permanent party there or anything like that. He had some time. He wasn't a new recruit, so to say, at that point. And what is different from this is that they were monitored on camera. The military judge found that there was 29 cameras watching them at all times.
Weren't the other trainees monitored by camera, too?
In T-Flight, Your Honor?
No, in FACE, the trainees themselves.
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I don't know that the military judge made a finding whether or not other trainees were.
I was just going by the testimony.
Oh, okay. Yes, Your Honor. But many.
Excuse me.
No,
I'm just me.
Okay. McKelly feels that these restrictions are enough to trigger 707 in this case. Now, certainly, I cited Murr in the opinion. Different, it's distinguishable from this case, but it is certainly lends itself credibility to the decision in this case. That involved a T-flight at Lackland, where they did find that it triggered the 707 in that case. And certainly that was unpublished as well. But as the government cited Glaze in their case, Glaze, again, is distinguishable as it seemed to point to whether or not it was tantamount to confinement. That's not necessarily issue in this case as well. And the military judge did distinguish it in his findings of fact, where he said that Glaze was different. Glaze was allowed to go anywhere on base. Now, he had to be escorted when he went anywhere on base. Apelli, in this case, was not allowed to go anywhere on base. He was allowed one trip to the mini mall and one trip to the library a week under escort. So there is somewhat of a difference.
Counsel, how do we get beyond 305H when there's the Shepherd or AETC reg that basically says the reason, the purpose that they're putting these troublemakers into transition flight is to basically segregate them and so they don't, in essence, poison the training environment. A command purpose, not a UCMJ pretrial restraint purpose. If that is their purpose, then it would appear that RCM 305H would say, okay, well, under other circumstances, this might constitute pretrial restraint, but not under this one, no, it's administrative restraint. And therefore, it doesn't start the clock. So how do we get beyond that, given the regulation that provided for this?
Yes, Your Honor. And certainly that's the purpose that they assert in that regulation. But just because they label it that way doesn't necessarily mean that is what it is. I mean, we have to look to the facts of what the appellee actually endured in that. I mean, certainly they can call it administrative restraint. But when we look at this, it seems to be a lot more than administrative restraint, what the facts lend it to, Your Honor.
Well, how do you distinguish this situation from that in Bradford, the Court of Military Appeals case, where it was dealing with a restriction on liberty on a ship, and with the basis being this guy was restricted to his boat because he might create an international incident because he'd been in trouble. How do you distinguish, which the court said was fine, it did not start the speedy trial clock. How do you distinguish this case from that one?
And I see I'm out of time, Your Honor. If I may answer your question.
Sure.
Okay. I'm not real clear on the facts of the Bradford case off the top of my head, but I believe, based I think that would be certainly different circumstances, especially on a Navy ship like that, in an international situation. We didn't necessarily have that here, where appellees at Shepherd Air Force Base in a training status, I think it would be distinguishable on those grounds, Your Honor. If I may briefly conclude, Your Honor, I know I'm out of time. Appellee's rights are not insignificant. The standard is active prosecution, and the government failed to meet its burden, showing that it was diligent, especially in light of the fact that appellee was and still is in pretrial confinement. The only option for a violation of Article 10 UMCMJ is dismissal of the charges with prejudice. The military judge's findings of fact are not erroneous. His application and understanding of the law is correct, and his ruling to dismiss the charges with prejudice was proper. Accordingly, appellee respectfully requests his honorable court to deny the government's Article 62 appeal. Thank you, Your Honors.
Major Portico?
Yes, Your Honor. Briefly. First, I would like to respond to the court's question with respect to the event that triggered the appellee's placement in Condition 1 status. Unfortunately, it's not directly clear from the record from what I can see with respect to any misconduct. The only reference is the commander's affidavit or a memorandum stating that he was increasingly disorderly while he was in T-flight, and that's at Appellate Exhibit 4, page 18. What's clearer is Appellate Exhibit 4 at page 35, where the PCRO discusses the mental health result, the result of the appellee's mental health analysis that took place on the 9th of April, stating that he would benefit from a one-on-one setup, which is ultimately what led to his placement in Condition 1 status. And the United States believes that this would further give credence to the argument that this is a 304H situation as opposed to restraint as found by the military judge in this case. The appellee made several references to Blaze and distinguished it as an Article 13 case, but asked this court to rely on Murr, which was squarely an Article 13 case, whereas Blaze involved both Article 13 and Article 10. And what the court did in its analysis was take its Article 13 tantamount to confinement analysis and use it in the context of Article 10 in determining that the restraints, same base, same program, were administrative restraints under 304H and not restraint under 304 restraint under 304 2 through 4. And so they apply the King factors and the totality test outlined and determine that it was in fact administrative restraint. The appellee also did exactly what the military judge did, which is to point to when the evidence was available, like the military judge kept reiterating the availability of the report of investigation, which is not evidence. And the appellee did the same thing today, where the evidence was known to the government. There was a confession in Casio, and the court still found that the government has the opportunity to marshal and weigh all of the evidence in its case before proceeding. They're under no obligation to proceed blindly or to solely rely on the confession before proceeding in order to be compliant with the reasonable diligence standard. So the appellee's reference to the lack of progress made by the government is a misapplication of what's required. The attachments to the reconsideration motion, the emails, even the email by the defense counsel in this case, indicate the early and often discussions with all of the defense counsel in these five separate cases regarding PTA discussions in an effort to obtain post-trial immunity. It's made clear. In Barker, there were 4 years involved. Here we're talking about a 57-day period, which they were actively seeking negotiations and were unable to do so and change course. The appellee also seeks to ask this court to rely on Hatfield, which is wholly distinguishable from this case for a variety of reasons, one in particular being the one-year gap between preferral and referral, and then and then ultimately no evidence that the government was moving forward for a significant period of time. So the United States would encourage the court to strongly look at the distinguishing factors between this case and Hatfield. And finally, it's important to reference, this is a very important fact, to reference the appellee's citation of the deference that the court gave in Hatfield to the military judge's findings. The standard of review in this case is de novo. It is well settled, and it's important for the court not to think otherwise. The deference was given to the military judge's careful consideration in Casio, and the court still reversed because he misapplied the law, which is exactly what the military judge did in this case. And subject to the court's questions, may I briefly conclude?
Sure.
In a case that required the delicate balance of five prosecutions stemming from a single drug ring, the government's strategic considerations and the steps it took to move appellee's case to trial constituted reasonable diligence. Additionally, the 118 days appellee served in pretrial confinement did not violate the requirements of RCM 707. And in any event, the scope of his dismissal was overly broad with respect to charge 2. For these reasons, the United States respectfully requests that this court set aside the military judge's dismissal and remand the case for further proceeding.
Thank you, Major Parker. Thank you for those arguments. We will issue our opinion in due course. This court is adjourned.
All rise.